Iowa has been at the center of the presidential campaign since the middle of last year. In less than a week, campaigning will end and we will have a result. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Keefe. The last politics day before the election, one outcome is already known. Given how close this election is, the loser is likely to blame Sandy. This hour, we'll look at the hurricane's impact on the election and other developments on the political landscape. Our analysts today, Stephen Schmidt of Iowa State University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. What are your thoughts as we enter these final days of campaigning? Start right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we've been through it, and we are almost at the finish line. Iowa at the center of the presidential race, going back to fairly intense speculation, campaigning since mid-2011, a year and a half. In less than a week, it's all over. We will have a result. And we want to chew over the latest political developments on the landscape with our guests this week on the last Politics Wednesday before the general election. Tim Hagel is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Hi, Tim.
Hi there.
And Stephen Schmidt, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Ben.
Quick question before we start. Do even political junkies, people who make a career out of this, get sick of it at this point, Stephen?
I'm actually looking forward to November 7th, when the 2016 Iowa caucus season begins. So, you know, I'm fading this one out, but I'm hungry for the next election.
Oh, insatiable you are, Stephen Schmidt. Let's get right to the effects of Hurricane Sandy. Renewed debate due to the hurricane about the role of government and highlighting the difference, or at least the perceived differences, between the presidential candidates. President Obama suspended campaign events for a third day today to tour the damage in New Jersey, elsewhere. And speaking at a Red Cross center, I believe yesterday, about the disaster, the president called for a united response.
Yeah, this is a tough time for a lot of people, millions of folks all across the eastern seaboard. But America's tougher, and we're tougher because we pull together. We leave nobody behind. We make sure that we respond as a nation and remind ourselves that whenever an American is in need, all of us stand together to make sure that we're providing the help that's necessary. So,
Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney also suspending campaign yesterday. His wife, though, Ann, was in Des Moines yesterday, encouraging supporters to help with relief efforts to vote for her husband. Mitt Romney also revamped a campaign rally in Ohio to collect aid for disaster victims, although the campaign video still played for the audience. It's not Romney's recent words that have been the focus of most of the attention in the past few days. It is the comments he made during a Republican primary debate in which he called for a decentralized approach to disaster relief. Let's listen.
Every time you have an occasion to take something from the federal government and send it back to the states, that's the right direction. And if you can go even further and send it back to the private sector, that's even better.
And during that same debate, when pressed about which federal programs should be considered for cuts to bring the deficit under control, Romney declined to take funding for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, off the table.
We should take all of what we're doing at the federal level and say, what are the things we're doing that we don't have to do? And those things we've got to stop doing, because we're borrowing $1.6 trillion more this year that we're taking in.
Including disaster relief.
We cannot afford to do those things without jeopardizing the future for our kids.
We want to make clear that the Romney campaign says he would not eliminate FEMA, but wants to put the states in control of disaster assistance. Tim Hagel, your thoughts on the issue of disaster relief that this has brought to the fore and the effect on this campaign?
Well, you know, even in that clip, listening carefully, Romney didn't specifically say that he wanted to reduce FEMA's budget. It was sort of the questioner sort of threw that in as Romney was already answering his question. But even aside from that, that's the problem that we face, is that when we're talking about dealing with cuts and reducing spending and so forth, that if you start taking this program off the table and that program off the table, because they're good programs, people like them, but you have to cut somewhere if you're going to cut anywhere. And, you know, regardless of whether it's the big bird, which stirred up a lot of controversy apparently a week or so ago or whenever the first debate was, and now with revisiting the FEMA comments, those are good programs, but the question is, are they still bigger than they need to be? And, of course, when you have a situation like with the Superstorm Sandy, that's where you get a test to see, well, is it big enough? Is it doing what it needs to do? And in terms of the centralization, decentralization question, that's pretty much the status quo now. And when you have well-prepared states like New York and New Jersey, even for terrible natural disasters like this, they're doing a good job and it seems to be working. Of course, with Hurricane Katrina, Louisiana government was not well prepared and that turned into a bigger problem.
Stephen Schmidt, do you see any real difference between the candidates here that this disaster relief is bringing out?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's completely absurd to say that each town, each county, and each state should stockpile its own disaster relief capability. Generators, vehicles, you know, rescue equipment, and so on. The cost of that would be disastrous and would divert funds in places that may never have a disaster. So the reason we have a defense department and a national military is because we don't want every state to have to defend itself against enemy attacks. And for the same reason, we have a federal capability of shifting equipment to those areas where it's needed and thereby providing essentially a very cost-effective way of responding to disasters. And, you know, a businessman like Mitt Romney ought to understand that. I mean, it's a return on investment issue. You have the generators and all the other capability in one agency or several federal agencies, and then you move them around as disasters appear.
Is it clear-cut who would do the better job, Tim Hagel? The local governments, if you channel the same funds to state and local governments, if they're going to do a worse job than them?
I can't say that making the analogy to the Department of Defense is entirely appropriate. Now, there are going to be some big-ticket items or large expense items that the federal government, at a minimum, can provide funding for. But the states are often going to know what's more appropriate for their particular needs. And so especially when you're talking at the police and firefighter level and so forth, that they have to be ready for a range of possible problems that they would face, whether it's natural disasters or anything else. And so basically what it means is you have to strike a balance. And Romney would like to see the balance shifted a little bit more towards the states and localities, even to a certain extent the private sector, as he indicated. But Obama, of course, would rather see it more of a centralized top-down situation.
Well, just ask Chris Christie.
Okay, we will. You know, as far as the states taking the lead on disaster recovery, we did hear indeed from New Jersey Governor Chris Christie this week, a man who spoke at the Republican National Convention in support of Mitt Romney, praising the Obama administration for its response thus far. This is Chris Christie this week.
I have to say the administration, the president himself, and FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate have been outstanding with us so far, and I want to thank the president personally for his personal attention to this.
Stephen Schmidt, surprised there? That much praise for Obama?
Chris Christie is very pragmatic. Chris Christie is a risk manager. He does not want to essentially, be a this attack bulldog. He doesn't know for sure who's going to get elected in this cycle around. Barack Obama is ahead in all of these really sophisticated projection models of who's going to win the election. And Chris Christie knows that there is going to be a need for a Republican candidate, possibly in 2016. And I think that's very interesting.
Tim Hagel.
You know, I wouldn't put quite the political spin on what Chris Christie was saying, that basically, as he himself indicated, is that he calls him like he sees him. If he sees somebody's doing a good job, he'll say so. If he thinks somebody's doing a bad job, he'll say that. And he certainly has called out President Obama on other issues. But at least in this one, he thought, okay, you're doing a good job. You got the disaster relief to us quickly. You declared the area disaster area, freed up the red tape. And so he's willing to say so. And, you know, he may have designs on 2016 or 2020, depending on what happens on November 6th. But I don't think that really came into his calculations in terms of praising President Obama for what's occurred so far.
Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Just a few days left before our general election in 2012. 1-866-780-9100. Your thoughts as the days wind down to the final election day, November 6th, next Tuesday. River2River@iowapublicradio.org, our email. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. I want to ask the two of you for some general thoughts on how do you campaign after a disaster? Are there set rules, Stephen Schmidt?
You campaign like porcupines making love, very, very carefully. Instead of campaigning, you pretend that you're running a food bank and you're getting people to bring little bags of canned goods and other things that you are then going to send to the disaster area on your campaign bus, which says Mitt Romney for president on the side. You do not campaign, but instead you stay in the White House and you put your chin in your hand and look very carefully at the video screen of your disaster response team. And you say, I'm not going to be campaigning because we can't do that when people are suffering and dying. And so you campaign through alternate means, but you're still campaigning.
Mm-hmm. Do you see it the same way, Tim Hagel? As cynically, if I could say, as Stephen Schmidt.
I was going to say,
guys,
boy.
This is politics. Are you people really this
today.
Naive?
Well, it's not a question of it. You know, it's always a balance between it. You know, to a certain extent, yes, you do continue your campaign. You do need to remain to be visible. So there are basically opportunities and obstacles for both the incumbent and the challenger. And for the president, of course, has that opportunity to be presidential, but he must also be careful to not step over the line and appear to be inserting himself in such a way that then he can be accused of being political. And the same is true for the challenger, even more so. And of course, they both had their surrogates out on the campaign trail anyway, so it's not like they completely suspended their campaigns.
Do you think they succeeded in their respective roles as challenger and sitting president in responding to this disaster with just a few days before the election? Tim Hagel, you first.
Yeah, so far I think they have. We'll see what happens over the next couple of days, and of course the campaigns are starting to ramp up today and tomorrow again. But I think that for the most part, the president's been presidential without inserting himself too much. And Romney has done what he thought was appropriate, some relief type efforts without mm-hmm. being too political about it. He's toned down some of the rhetoric and the campaign events.
Stephen Schmidt, you agree with that?
I think they're doing a pretty good job of pretending that they're not campaigning. Yep.
Okay. Well, let's look at the national polls, what they're saying. And a lot of the poll data comes, of course, prior to this hurricane. We don't know what influence that will have on there. Do you think, let's go back to you, I guess you could argue that Hurricane Sandy both elevated the president and stopped the momentum that the narrative of Mitt Romney had. Do you think that? So you could also say that, Sandy has kept the president off the campaign trail for a few days. Do you think there's a winner and loser, purely politically speaking, in terms of this hurricane? Tim?
I'm not sure that it's clear yet. That's the big question. That supposedly some polls were showing Romney still had some momentum that he picked up in the first debate, slowed a little bit, but still seemed to be making advances. Of course, there were some polls that still had Obama maybe pulling ahead or still ahead a little bit. And so the question is what's going to happen over the next few days? If a lot of places get power pretty quickly, people will be happy. On the other hand, if there seem to be major problems that pop up, then maybe that will hurt the president a little bit more than even local officials. Mm-hmm. So it's, we just have to wait and see. And basically what I've been telling folks for the last week or so at least is that at this point, ignore the polls. Everybody in the campaign should work as hard as they can on turnout, and we'll just see what happens come Election Day.
Mm-hmm. The latest national survey by the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press finds Obama holding a statistically insignificant 2-point edge among registered voters, 47% to 45. The sample is narrowed to likely voters when it is. The balance of opinion shifts slightly to Romney's direction. So we have statistically a tie in the national, but that's not how we decide elections for the president, is it? The latest battleground polls. Barack Obama leading Mitt Romney by 5 points in the state of Ohio. We can agree that is the most important swing state, can we not?
Other than Iowa, of course.
Okay. Presidential campaign too close to call in Florida and Virginia. These latest numbers I'm throwing out according to the latest round of the Quinnipiac University and the New York Times and CBS polling. And any words to add there, Stephen Schmidt, about the latest polling?
Absolutely.
What you see developing?
No, absolutely. And I don't know if Tim agrees with me or not, but I do not look at individual polls. Individual polls have lots of different problems with them, and I prefer to go to two things. One is three very sophisticated computer models, Nate Silver's model, the Wang model from Princeton, and there are a couple of others that are very complicated, the Linzer Votomatic model. And all of those take a essentially mathematical and longitudinal approach to looking at the variability of polls. And what is shocking about it, I have to give a talk to the largest Rotary Club in Iowa tomorrow, actually, so I've got these numbers all here on PowerPoints, is that in Silver's model, for example, Mitt Romney never actually goes above Obama since June. And so it's not that you all of a sudden have one of them surging and the other one plunging. If you look at really good mathematical models, Obama has been slightly ahead in all of them and continues to be ahead. And the same holds true if you go to InTrade, which is an Irish stock market that you can buy stocks. Obama has been ahead, is still ahead. Obama's probability of winning is 63.9%, and that holds. And the same is true of a couple of other of these.
Nate Silver has 77.4% as of this morning.
Yeah.
Tim Hagel, how much weight do you give pictures like Nate Silver's on how likely things are to turn out that way?
Well, I would agree with Stephen that you really can't put too much weight on any individual poll. Nate Silver's models come under some significant criticism, mostly from the right, not surprisingly. And as far as some of these other polls, I always use a bit of caution when people say so-and-so's ahead, so-and-so's behind, because all these polls are just samples, and so you really don't know for sure. And one of the problems that some people have had with a lot of these polls is that their turnout models are based on the 2008 demographics, and the enthusiasm from 2008 for the Democrats just isn't there this year. And so that's the big question, and that's why I say that we really kind of have to say at this point, you know, don't worry about the polls, work on turnout. And I suspect that the turnout's going to be much better for Republicans than it was in 2008, a little bit less for Democrats than it was in 2008. And so it really boils down to what's going to happen with all the independent folks in the middle.
But the interesting thing is that all of the stock markets that trade politics, Betfair, InTrade, and the Iowa University of Iowa electronic market, they all give Obama a higher percentage chance of winning than Mitt Romney. And so whether that's people unwisely buying stock on Obama or not, I can't say. But I have bet on InTrade in the past, not physically, but by looking at it. And they've been extremely reliable in predicting the final outcome of elections.
Here's another group of people who have been extremely reliable predicting the winner of the popular vote in the past four presidential elections. Obama coming up in the top of this poll, 54% of Americans think Obama will win the election, compared to 32% predicting Mitt Romney. That's according to a Gallup poll released today. Let's see.
And Reuters, I have another one, which is Reuters Ipsos poll of October 30. 53% of people think Obama will win, and only 29% say Romney. Now, those are opinion polls, so you know that's what people think.
Right. Well, some of these polls have led to reading in Politico some what they call four freak possible election outcomes that could happen. The most possible of the unlikely scenarios would be that there would be this popular vote, electoral college vote split. How likely do you see that, Tim, happening?
Not very. I mean, we know that, of course, that it happened 12 years ago in the 2000 election, and that's part of the reason why many people, mostly on the left, are concerned about matching up the Electoral College and the popular vote in some particular way, either through constitutional amendment or some sort of a roundabout method. But I just don't see that it's happening again. It could, of course. It's a possibility because this is a close race nationally. But if it breaks for one candidate or the other over the next few days, and especially if the candidate wins by, you know, 3, 4, 5 points, it's probably much less likely that you'll have that split.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to a caller before we have to take a break. Jay is in Keosauqua. Hi, Jay.
Yeah. I wanted to ask this question since something that's been pretty obvious. How can a newspaper like the Des Moines Register that has written editorial after editorial all throughout the summer about how Romney's ideas were bogus, about how they weren't good suited to our state, like the wind jobs all over across our state that are already, like in Fort Madison, lost 400 wind jobs, the health care system, he would totally tear apart, you name the issue, Medicare, they had editorial all through the summer. And then they turn around and they endorse this fraud.
Okay.
And what gets me is, don't the editorial writers have input into the decision
okay.
they endorse?
Look, we've got just a couple minutes, Jay. Let's get the input from both of our guests here, because we're why newspapers give endorsements and why, in this case, Tim?
Just real quick, yeah, the last part of that, yes, the editorial writers did have input into that, and they were apparently split on it. But the thing is that it's a difference between what types of issues they saw as important. That I know many Democrats that I was following were, you know, confounded by that. But I think that what they saw was that despite their disagreements with Romney on some of the issues that are more important to the base, the overarching issue had to do with the economy, and that's where they saw Romney as being the more appropriate person for the presidency.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Schmidt, in the minute before our break.
It's pretty easy. Obama dissed the Des Moines Register. They wanted, I mean, I had coffee with the opinion page editor, who's a good friend of mine, just before all this broke. They wanted Obama to come and meet with their editorial board and talk about why he should be president. He refused to do it. He called them a few days before they endorsed Romney and said, I'll give you an interview on the phone. I'll give you half an hour. They said, okay, fine. And he said, yes, but it's got to be anonymous, or it's got to be not for quotation, not for attribution. So I'm just going to talk to you, but you can't publish it. And it just ticked off the Des Moines Register publisher and the editor. They were furious at him. They said, what is this? You're the president of the United States. You're going to not talk to us, and then you're going to call us from Florida and give us half an hour of stuff that is, you know, off the record? Forget about it. Mm-hmm. And I think they just were angry at him, frankly.
But that's not in their decision. I mean, that seems fairly petty compared to the national issues.
You're all underestimating the degree to which personal things interject themselves into what should be, you know, highfalutin and public policy things. But I think they were angry at Obama and thought that that was unpresidential. And yes, they probably think that, you know, somebody else might do a better job with the economy. But did they come up with that just at the last minute, since they actually for months and months and months were banging up
on Romney? We have to go in a moment, Stefan. Was this a mistake for President Obama?
Yeah, it probably was, except that I've heard that Mitt Romney is really furious that the Register endorsed him.
Okay, we'll come back with more of Politics Wednesday here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Stephen Schmidt with us of Iowa State University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. When we come back, we also want to include in our discussion the congressional races. 4 districts after reapportionment up for grabs. We'll go through the districts, get our political watchers' views on that, perhaps a comment or a question from you as well. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Hard to imagine. A week from today, we will be dissecting the results, digesting the results. Well, we'll do a little pre-digesting in just a moment. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday, the last one before Election Day next Tuesday. Tim Hagel with us of the University of Iowa, political scientist Stephen Schmidt from Iowa State University, and talking this hour about the impact Hurricane Sandy's having on this election, and given how close this election is, won't be surprising if the losing side ends up blaming Sandy, whether that's fair or not. This input from Greg in Cedar Rapids, he wrote us an email. I enjoyed Governor Christie's presentation at the Republican National Convention, but was surprised at how it was reported, making his message only a challenge to the Democratic incumbent. To my ear, his comments and challenges clearly were aimed at both parties and candidates, challenging them equally to lead, follow, or get out of the way. His current message of credit where credit is due seems to be a pragmatic continuation of his message, not spin only for the benefit of the New Jersey recovery. I might quibble with some of Governor Christie's positions, but I wish his call for pragmatism at the federal level would get a lot more support. Thank you for that, Greg, in Cedar Rapids. Join our conversation either by email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or by phone, 1-866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. Gentlemen, Stefan and Tim, what do you make of this? David Axelrod, senior advisor to President Obama's presidential campaign, saying today he would shave off his mustache of 40 years on national television if President Obama loses Minnesota, Michigan, or Pennsylvania on Election Day. What do you make of that, Stefan?
I don't know. He probably stayed up too late.
These have been put not in the safe, but the leaning Obama category, three states.
Well, that's right. They have been. And, again, I refer you to computer models that aggregate a lot of data and don't rely on individual polling. Of course, we don't know, I think, as Tim correctly pointed out, and as you did too, Ben, this hurricane is the October surprise. This hurricane is that sudden event that happens a week before the election that creates a level of uncertainty that is astonishingly high. It's like a sex scandal, only in this case, it's a natural disaster. And neither Obama nor Romney's campaign playbook had that penciled in for the last week of the campaign. And that means that the best laid plans of both campaigns have been smashed to smithereens. And they now have to essentially try to figure out the implications of it for their respective last sprint to the White House. So that's what I'm interested in. And I think that shaving off your mustache is a great thing. He would probably look fine without a mustache anyway. So get her done.
Let's talk quickly about the U.S. Senate, the U.S. House, before moving to the congressional races here in Iowa. Lots of talk by Republicans about taking back the U.S. Senate. How likely does that look now, Tim Hagel?
Not very likely. I mean, my best guess would be that Democrats will retain control of the Senate. There are a number of open seats that are possibilities. And again, it really kind of depends on whether the race breaks for one candidate or the other. If it breaks, of course, for Obama, then I can't imagine Republicans would take the Senate. If it breaks for Romney, particularly if the national vote ends up 5 or more points ahead, then some of those close races in various states, the Republicans might have a chance to take them.
Mm-hmm. When you look at the Senate races, do you come to the same conclusion, Stefan?
I do, and I'm not much of a fan of presidential coattails anyway. I think that a lot of data sort of suggests that those independent or no-party voters, you know, very often still actually split their tickets. So, it just seems to me that the Republicans have had a couple of suicidal Republicans running for the Senate who have shot themselves at the very least in the foot and probably in the mouth with some of their statements about rape and abortion and so on, which really knocked their campaigns off, I think, off balance. The Massachusetts race is very interesting, where Scott Brown really has a threat to his reelection. So I'm guessing the Democrats will retain the Senate, and of course the Republicans, with a few fewer seats, will retain the House. And so gridlock will live on for the next 2 years.
Listeners to River, tell us about the local race you're following. Where does it stand? What do you think will happen? Let's talk about some congressional races. Iowa down from 5 districts to 4 due to reapportionment after the census. Let's take these districts one at a time. The first district in northeast Iowa, challenger Ben Lang in a rematch with incumbent Democrat Bruce Braley. What's this race looking like, Tim Hagel?
Well, there was a recent poll that suggested that Lang was within a few points of Braley, but Braley's a strong campaigner, a good fundraiser, and even though he's in a new district and has to reintroduce himself to a lot of folks that are new to that district, which decreases his incumbency advantage, He seems to be doing a fairly good job. And most places that rate the races still have that in, if not a safe Democratic seat, at least it's likely to go for Braley.
Mm-hmm. Do you see it the same way, Stefan?
Well, I think so, especially because both he and Loebsack, both of them are alumni and former students of mine, by the way, are in a media market, you know, that's very similar and overlapping. So a lot of people will have heard both Loebsack and Braley's names and probably are more familiar with them than they would be, you know, if they were distinctly separate media markets for both of them. So, I mean, I think Braley has been a strong representative of his district, and he'll probably get by and get reelected.
Let's jump over to the 4th District, perhaps the most watched race in the Iowa races nationally, the congressional races, over to where you are. Ames, Stefan, included in this district now, and former First Lady of Iowa, Kristi Vilsack, the Democratic challenger to the longtime Republican Congressman Steve King, 39 counties in north central, northwestern part of the state. Stefan, how do you see this race? Do you see Kristi Vilsack really the one who has to climb the hill here, isn't it?
To some extent, but Steve King is running worried. I mean, he's debated her, which he's never done with any other challenger, and several of the polls show her within, you know, 4 or 5 points of King. So again, I think what Tim said probably holds here. You know, if Obama gets a good turnout, it could help Kristi Vilsack defeat the incumbent. And I think voters are actually getting a little tired of gridlock and of the Tea Party and so on. And Steve King is very much identified, you know, with saying no. He voted against disaster relief for Katrina, one of the 10 Republicans who did that, and she pulled that out and beat him up in the last debate on that. And I think a lot of people, especially independents, may find that, you know, not to be, you know, a very good move. So I think this is a competitive race, shockingly.
Are you putting it in the toss-up column?
I think it's slightly in favor of Steve King, but astonishingly, Kristi Vilsack has run a campaign not as a liberal Democrat, but as a very kind of moderate campaigner, and has gone to small towns and talked about economic development in those places, has avoided the really big, hot, controversial, sizzling issues that Steve King would have liked to sucker in into. And so my view is that King has the advantage, but Vilsack is giving him a pretty good run for the money.
And interestingly, the former First Lady of Iowa, Kristi Vilsack, not appearing with President Obama in this election season. How do you see the 4th District race, Tim Hagel?
Well, pretty much the same way. Of course, the 4th District is the one that has the largest imbalance in favor of Republicans in terms of voter registration. So that means Vilsack's got a really tough hill to climb. I saw some Democrats in my Twitter feed last night after the debate suggesting that she just wasn't as good a candidate as they hoped that she would be, and it may be because she was going for a lot of those smaller issues. And one of the things that struck me, and I've heard her mention this, it's a good line in talking about how, because of her experience with children, she knows how to deal with unruly behavior or adolescent behavior. And that's a funny line, and it always gets a laugh, but it's kind of insulting even for potential Democratic colleagues in the House. So, you know, I don't know that just sitting down and getting people in a room is the kind of argument you can make that's going to solve the problem.
She's going to be strong in Ames. Is it really these rural voters that she has to peel away from Steve King?
Well, that's what she's tried to do, because she's always emphasized in every debate that I've heard her talking about the importance of rural and small communities. And obviously with the preponderance of those in that district, that's something that she clearly has to talk about.
And Tim, you realize, of course, that nobody watches those debates. I mean, you and I and Ben watch them, and also Mrs. King and, you know, Vilsack, Governor Vilsack. But, you know, people just don't watch those debates. So
I think you're right. By the time of the 7th debate last night, that there did not seem to be a lot of activity in terms of the Twitter comments that were following
much
the debate.
Let's move to the 3rd District. Which includes central Iowa counties, Polk and Dallas, the capital city, but also stretching into the southwest part of the state. Eight-term Democratic incumbent Congressman Leonard Boswell, This is a rare race between two incumbents, only a couple of these in the country, against nine-term Republican Tom Latham from Iowa's old 4th District. Let's give you, Tim, the first shot at this one.
This is an interesting race because you would think an incumbent versus incumbent race would really draw a lot of attention. But because both men are a little more moderate from their parties and both low-key in terms of their approach, it hasn't got as much attention. I'm sure the folks in especially Polk County are getting plenty of advertising for the various campaigns. But, you know, those of us a little further away are just not seeing it quite as much. It seems that for both of them, they're having to work a little bit harder in terms of introducing themselves. Boswell had only previously represented Polk County in the new district, whereas Latham represented three of the collar counties. So they've got that whole sort of southwest corner to work. And so they've had to deal with that to a certain extent. And so it's going to be interesting to see what happens there. It seems that Latham has a slight edge, and there's a slight edge in terms of Republican voter registration in the district, but not that much.
Mm-hmm. Is that the way you see it, Stefan?
Well, this is a weird race. And the reason it's weird is because you've got one of the few remaining sort of moderate Republicans running against one of the few remaining conservative Democrats. I mean, you know, Boswell is pro-life. A lot of people don't know that. And so it just sort of very strange because they both are essentially kind of centrists, and they've got a district that has a large rural component. It's got a large suburban component. And so it's been a slugfest. It's like Mad Magazine spy versus spy, you know. I think people thought that Boswell looked old and was kind of burned out and tired, but he showed an incredible amount of spunk in some of the debates, which nobody watched. And his ads have become much more targeted and brutal, and he's pulling, of course, his military service in Vietnam, as you know, in the latest ads, which is highly compelling, and unfortunately, Latham, you know, can't pull his uniform out of his closet.
So what are the issues that will decide this in terms of what the voters are looking to for these candidates in that district? Any thoughts?
Well, you know, it's the same issues as everybody else. You know, it's the deficit. Are the Republicans, you know, really essentially going to skunk all of the programs that have made Iowa rural areas and farmers prosperous by cutting a lot of the you know, tax benefits for wind and ethanol and other things? And I think, you know, Republicans are saying that Boswell is a typical liberal Democrat, which he isn't on social issues. And I think they're making essentially the biggest issues have been who has wasted taxpayers' money more. Is it Latham because his family bank got lots of bailout money and now the Latham family is five times richer than they were before? Or is it, you know, Boswell because he gave his staff a raise when Iowa voters are suffering and hunkering down in little hovels, you know, burning firewood? That's been the public tone of that campaign anyway.
Let's get quickly to judicial retention. That will be on the back of the ballot. If you haven't already voted, you will need to turn your ballot over here in Iowa, and you will see several of the Supreme Court justices listed there up for retention. Of course, the one everybody's focused on, Justice David Wiggins, part of the unanimous Iowa Supreme Court decision that paved the way for same-sex marriage in Iowa in 2009. He stands for retention this year. The family leader, the same conservative group that waged a successful campaign to remove the three other justices involved in the case years ago, has campaigned for his defeat this year. Tim Hagel, do you see a difference in the campaigns this year between this year and 2010?
Well, yes, in the sense that the No Wiggins campaign isn't as central as it was in 2010. Obviously, in a presidential year, the presidential campaign is going to take a central role, and so there isn't as much effort. You've only, you know, focusing on one justice. It's a little bit harder, I suppose. You did, of course, initially have pushback from the people that want to retain Wiggins, and they had some early advertising on, but I haven't seen as much of it of late, and more for the No Wiggins folks, and so it's not clear exactly what's going on. But the thing is it's always very, very difficult to remove a judge or a justice. I was a big surprise in 2010 where three of them were removed, but this time it's going to be harder. And even if it's, you know, very close, maybe 52-53% in favor of Wiggins, he still gets to have another term.
Okay. We want to remind our listeners that we'll be focusing the entire hour on this topic, judicial retention, tomorrow on River to River. Do you think it will have a different outcome, Stephen Schmidt, than it did 2 years ago in 2010?
You know, I think it will. One thing is that we aren't used to having actual contests with supporters and detractors of, you know, Supreme Court justices campaigning. And so I think in 2010, the justices were essentially, you know, fish in a tank that could be shot without even knowing that what was coming. This time around, there is a bus that says yes following the bus that says no. There's a real campaign going on. People are giving money and volunteering. And so this has been an actual election contest the way you would expect someone running for state legislature or something. And I think that's pushback. In any case, it's Bob Vanderplaats's sort of, you know, last chance, you know, to be politically relevant in Iowa, I guess. And he's going to make a big effort to try and get no and get one more of those judges that voted for gay marriage to be picked off.
A battle, of course, underway for the control of Iowa's Senate. When we talk about state races, far too many to go through. But Democrats holding a single one-vote majority in the Iowa Senate. Republicans say defeating the Senate's top Democrat, Mike Gronstahl, would be the biggest prize. Comments on how that's likely to go, Tim Hagel?
Well, again, I would go back to the idea of that it's going to depend on what the turnout in the state is. That, that if you get Obama a break for Obama or a break for Romney strong, that you will get some coattails. And I would agree with what Stephen said earlier in that you probably don't get a lot. But because we're just so close, even a little bit could make a difference in some of these close races.
How do you see it? And Stephen, what would be the consequences of having the Senate split? Rather flip is the verb I'm looking for, flip into the Republican column.
Well, it would have a big consequence for one issue in particular, and that is a constitutional amendment on gay marriage, because that's where the dam was that prevented that, you know, from coming up. You know, and it does have a large consequence when you have both legislative branches controlled by the same party. I mean, we know that the checks and balances that produce checks or gridlock can slow things down and can change the outcome of legislative battles. And it would certainly give Governor Branstad, a green light on a lot of things that he has wanted to push through that hasn't been possible because the Senate was there to block it. So it's a big deal. It is a really, really big deal.
Zooming out to the national race before we have to say goodbye for today, but we talked about all the computer models, the predicting going on at the national level. Let's just focus in on Iowa, get your views on who is likely to win the state of Iowa in the presidential election, Iowa's electoral votes. Tim Hagel?
You know, I just always avoid the actual prediction thing. I think it still is going to depend on how the campaigns are able to ramp up continue their turnout efforts over the last few days. And we'll just see what happens.
Stephen, any predictions for what column Iowa will go into?
I think Obama will win, but not by much. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the mathematical computer models, all the tracking polls and the aggregates show him continuously slightly ahead in spite of spikes for Romney. And so I think Obama will take Iowa.
Let's fast forward to next Tuesday, election night, the returns starting to come in. Tim Hagel, and then to you, Stephen, what will you be watching most closely as the returns come in election night? What will be the signpost up ahead that says who our next president will be?
I'm starting to sound like a broken record, but I'm going to be looking at the turnout because I want to see what the ratio is between Democrats and Republicans in terms of how enthusiastic they were. That's one of the things we've talked about a lot over the last several months is the enthusiasm gap that Democrats have. And so we'll see if, in fact, that gap existed, if the Obama campaign was able to overcome it.
Okay. Are you going to be looking at a particular state in the East, perhaps Ohio, Stephen?
Yeah. I mean, we've got those, I don't know, maybe by now it's four or five states that are crucial to a Republican victory. And by definition, therefore, if Romney does very well in those states, he'll win. It looks less and less likely if the polls hold and if the Democrats turn out in the numbers that they need to turn out for. And of course, again, I'm saying that you know, the latest sort of events with the hurricane and so on might affect voter turnout in some of these places, and so that could throw a monkey wrench in it. But overall, I'm going to be looking for you know, the states that are in play, and they shrink in number now. You know, Florida is an iffy state, but I think it's still in play. Virginia is in play. Obviously, you know, Ohio and Wisconsin and Iowa and Colorado are the ones to watch, and the rest of the country we don't care about because they're either red or blue.
Okay, Stefan Schmidt, professor of political science at Iowa State University, and Tim Hagel, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Stefan and Tim, thank you very much for the hour.
Welcome.
Thanks, Ben.
Another reminder, judicial retention will be the topic tomorrow on this program. All the facts and arguments surrounding the retention of Justice David Wiggins. So we'll ask the question, also, what makes a judicial system political? River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan, and Ames help from Jason Burns. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.